Good afternoon. Actually, you've forgotten it, but I preached an absolutely brilliant sermon that day, but you haven't remembered a word of it.
I didn't think it was all that good.
No, I didn't either. You've just reminded me. I put a thing on, I usually say on Facebook where I'm going to be because it lets people know I'm behaving and doing proper things. And this is 2 or 3 years ago. I put on, next week I will be in such and such a church preaching. And a guy who'd been in the congregation the week before, it seemed a little strange as I was preaching, but he put a response on saying, well, I hope it's better than the one you preached last week. So anyhow, it's really good to be here. And I've been given the task of speaking to you from Luke chapter 12, verses 13 to 21, because I think you're going through a series on Luke at the moment. Good. Thank you for letting me have the very best, well, one of the best passages in all of Luke's gospel. I will read it for you, and you can follow Luke chapter 12, verse 13 to 21. Luke 12, 13 to 21. And it's okay just to listen as well. I'm always reflect on the fact that the earliest Christians did not have a Bible. Nobody said to them, turn to the right page and follow, because they were hearing these stories for the very first time. And they would have listened with their eyes and their ears, and they would have drunk every word in. So listen like that today. Imagine you're hearing this for the very first time. Luke 12, 13. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus replied, man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? Then he said to them, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. And Jesus told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. And the man thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. And then he said to himself, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain, and I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you, then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? And Jesus concluded, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God. Margaret, would you just pass me the books that are down on your right-hand side? I'm going to give a little plug here, and you'll see why I'm doing the plug now. For years, I've written, alongside the preaching ministry, I've written books, and most of them have been on subjects like prayer and discipleship and holiness, all that kind of good stuff. And I think they all did some good. But about 10 years ago, I began to get rather antsy and irritated about it, because I thought, you know the problem with all of those books? The only people who will ever read them are other Christians. And then I thought, wouldn't it be nice to write something where you weren't preaching at people, you were just telling a story. But all through the story, it just bristled with deep truth. Yeah, the kind of story that if people followed it through would ultimately make them think about Jesus. And so 3 or 4 years ago, I wrote my first novel. Thought I would have to self-publish it. Then a publisher came along and said, we'd love to publish it. It got so well. Hello, how did you get to be so pretty? You've been taking pretty pills. I must try them. I would need an overdose. Wasn't that funny? So I wrote a book about a man who'd totally lost his faith and done something that he could never put right, Rooks at Dusk. And it got so well received that I thought, I'll try and do better next time. So I wrote a book called The Man Who Broke Into St. Peter's. It's a story of a guy who breaks into a church. And when the caretaker opens the church in the morning, he's still there. Now, it's a story that's got a bit of a link with this part of the world, because I based the actual church on Christchurch, just over the way, yeah. When I was writing the book, I had a map of Christchurch on the wall in front of me. And really, it's a story about what would happen to a church and a community if Jesus actually turned up. So the reason I'm telling you all that, and I'm going to, you see the link in a minute. Margaret and I decided last year was our 50th wedding anniversary. 50 years is a long time. Yeah. And I only look, what, 42, 43? And you need glasses. No, but we decided we wanted to do something to say thanks. So we decided that all of the royalties we're giving to a charity called Church Response for Refugees. Plus, any that we sell directly, we give another pound to that charity. And so far, I think we've given, it's around 2,500 at the moment, isn't it? So all of that is to say that the books retail at $8.99 each. But if you bought two, instead of it being £18, it would only be £15. Plus, wait for it, Scotsman makes a free offer. We'd throw in a free copy of A Terrible Beauty, which is a book I wrote on grace some years ago. Okay, that's just to say the books are there. If anybody is interested, Margaret will gladly supply you with a copy, and I'll even sign them for you. Right, enough of that. Why did I tell you all that about the book? Well, one, because it's a bit of shameless advertising, but I know how difficult it is to tell a really good story. Jesus was probably the best short storyteller of all time. And what makes his stories all the more remarkable? When I'm writing, Margaret's only duty is to supply me with cups of tea and to tiptoe past. Because I need quietness. I need to think. Jesus didn't have that space. He told stories that he made up spontaneously in the face of a situation or an individual. And if ever there was a story that applies perfectly to the situation in which it was told, and at the same time replies, I thought I ought to walk across because it's unfair on you guys because I can't make contact with you. Why are you a Liverpool supporter? I believe that there will be some Liverpool supporters in heaven, just not very many. Now, the reason I'm so grumpy about Liverpool is I wish Jurgen Klopp was the manager of Manchester United. I like Klopp. Yeah, this is a story that is relevant to the time Jesus told it and relevant to the age we live in. So let's set it in context. You did tell me you were going to leave. She said, I'll wait for the first 5 minutes, and if it's no good, I'm out of there. As a woman, that's as good as her word. I like the kind of church where you can insult each other. Do you? You always know you're among friends when you can. Now, think about the person that Jesus encountered. Now, remember, someone in the crowd said to him, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. There was an inheritance at stake, and this guy wanted to share. Probably his older brother was keeping all the money for himself. I thought, I'll just do something in preparation for today. So I Googled families split by inheritance. Do you know how many things come up? 84 million plus. Families get split over inheritances. When Margaret and I were in Newark leading a congregation there, it was our first or second week, and I was asked to conduct a funeral, so I didn't know the family. They weren't part of the regular congregation. I knew nothing about the family, but obviously something had split that family, because a couple of days after the funeral service, I got a really nasty letter from one of the relatives of the deceased person, which ended up, thanks for nothing, Mr. Yo. And what had happened was clearly I'd walked into a situation where a family was split over the inheritance of the person who just died. It happens. And this guy appeals to Jesus to arbitrate between him and his brother. The interesting thing is he got absolutely nowhere with Jesus. Jesus simply didn't want to know. He said, who made me the one to arbitrate? And then he gives him a warning. Watch out, he says, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. It's the old problem, as old as human beings, and as epidemic now as ever it was, of being fooled into thinking that the more things you have, the more contented you'll be. The old problem of resenting anybody else who's got more than I've got. Our whole economy, it's no exaggeration to say, is built on the concept of you need to get more and more stuff. That's what sustains the advertising industry. Have you got a really nice television? Well, we've got a better one, and you ought to buy it. Have you got a car that takes you from A to B? Get a better one. That's the whole thing. It's a philosophy of greed and discontentment. So, in the face of this person that he encounters who's demanding that Jesus arbitrates in the matter of the family inheritance, this legacy, Jesus expounds a principle. A very short sentence, but a very profound principle. He says, a person's life does not consist in the abundance of his or her possessions. Greed is a delusion. The more it gets, the more it wants. The things that it has never bring any satisfaction. The truth is this, that moral and spiritual values are far more important than material wealth and possessions. Who is the ultimate expression of the hedonistic, materialistic lifestyle? I'd suggest to you that the ultimate expression of that in popular culture is 007, James Bond. The man with all the gadgets, the man with the flashy cars, the man who always gets the best-looking women. Ian Fleming, who wrote the James Bond stories, himself a real expression of materialistic success, was once asked, what's it like to be rich and famous, to be able to go into any restaurant you like, to be able to buy anything you like? Ian Fleming said, when asked what's it like to be rich and famous, said simply, it's ashes, just ashes. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Jonathan Edwards, a great Christian leader of an earlier generation, once put it like this, if you want to identify the true riches in your life, ask yourself this question, what will be of value to you when you're lying on your deathbed with only a few days to live? If you want to know what are the true riches, ask what will be of value to you when you're lying on your deathbed with only a few days to live. Easter 2015. Six elderly robbers whose combined age comes to around 500, broke into the Hatton Garden Safe Deposit Company, where people had stored enormous wealth. Nobody knows how much was actually stored there. Some estimates even say it could be as much as £400 million worth. And these guys escaped with a whole lot of it. Because they said it's our one last job, the one that will set us up for life. I don't know who to feel more sorry for. The guys who did the heist, who are now all in jail, or the people who put their money in that safe deposit place saying, we don't even need to insure it, it is safe. That's our money for life. One woman commented, that's my whole life gone. A person's life does not consist in the abundance of their possessions. So here is Jesus facing a man with a problem. My brother won't share the inheritance with me. Jesus refuses to adjudicate. Jesus spells out a principle. Your life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. But, and this is what Jesus usually did, he never went on to preach the guy a sermon. What he did was to tell him a story. He's facing a person. He spells out a principle. And then he tells him a parable. Rich man, farmer, exceptionally good crop. So he says to himself, now, what shall I do? Where can I store all this? And he decides, I don't know what to do. I'll demolish my existing barns. I will build bigger ones. I'll store it. I've got so much. I can take it easy for the rest of my life. I can sit back and enjoy it. And God says, you fool. Tonight your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? It takes a minute to tell that story. And yet it's utterly satisfying. And I'll tell you what makes it really interesting. This man, the man in this story, the rich man, is the only man in the Gospels who is ever called by God a fool. And yet, he's not a bad man. There is no suggestion that he earned his money by anything other than honest and legitimate means. He was hardworking. He was obviously a good businessman. He was the kind of guy that if a church was deciding to put up a new building today, they'd try to get them on their advisory group. He's that kind of man. He's hardworking, he's honest, he's worth a fortune. He may donate something to the church. He's our man. And God calls him a fool. Now, I'll tell you why God calls him a fool, if you read the story carefully. Simply because he was spiritually short-sighted. He couldn't see beyond the end of his nose. Let me try and tease it out a bit. He couldn't see beyond his own wealth. Remember, the ground produced a good crop. What shall I do? I have no place to store it. And then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones and store all my grain and goods. This was his wealth, and his greatest concern was how to store it and hold on to it. And he forgot that hard though he had worked, his wealth was a gift from God. Who had created the processes of growth by which his crop grew? Who had provided the sunshine and the rain that made growth possible? Who had given him the gift of life itself? God. And he couldn't see that. His wealth had blinded him to the great truths of life. It had created a spiritual myopia and prevented him from seeing that God was the great giver and he was the unworthy recipient of God's gifts. That's why wealth is dangerous. It isn't wrong in itself, but it can make us think that we are self-made and self-sufficient. This is a man who couldn't see beyond his own wealth, my crops. He's also a man who couldn't see beyond his own wishes. Now listen again, listen carefully, and I'll emphasize his words this time. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and I will store all my grain and my goods, and I'll say to myself, you've plenty of good things, take life easy. Here is a man totally absorbed in his own wishes and desires, and he can see no further than what he wants. He's forgotten that there is a needy world all round him. Remember Bob Geldof and Band-Aid and Live Aid? Don't know if you've ever read Bob Geldof's biography, but one of the things that changed a self-satisfied rock musician into a campaigner for the needs of people in the developing world was an experience he had in a refugee camp in Mekelle, in Ethiopia. I'm going to read you just a paragraph from Bob Geldof's book. It's not a nice paragraph, I warn you that. He said, I came out of one of the long huts and I saw a small boy squatting in his own pool, in his pool of his own urine and diarrhea. He looked about 4 months old, but he was actually nearer two, the age of my own child in England. A tattered, dusty piece of cotton hung from one shoulder across his distended stomach. His face was huge, a two-year-old face on a four-month-old body. His eyes were moons of dust and flies. He was crying and the tears rolled down to the awful swollen stomach before they dried in the heat. And only a few yards away were his family, but they were too ill to notice. The diarrhea trickled out in a steady flow. And then as I stood there, Gelda says, as I watched, the child began to excrete his own intestines. He had nothing left inside to evacuate except the torn shreds of his own stomach, which had been ripped open by dry grain. I was watching a child die. There can be no doubt that the little boy is dead now, but he will not die in my imagination. That's a horrible story. But I defy anybody to recognize that that happens in our world. And to talk about my house, my car, my retirement pension, my possessions, my wealth. That's what was wrong with the spiritually short-sighted farmer. Couldn't see beyond his own wishes. Any wealth that I have is a gift from God and is given to me so that it can be shared with others. And for the Christian, that has an added importance. Because Jesus said, see that little child there dying? Inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these, my brothers, you've done it to me. What Geldof was seeing in that camp in Mekelle was in a very real sense Jesus himself in the shape of a little boy dying. ¥17,000 kids will die today in the developing world because of diseases that could be prevented by clean water and aspirin. Margaret and I had a funny experience a few years ago. We got left some money by a woman we didn't even know existed. Tell you what made it really interesting. Some weeks before that happened, and this we got this sum of money out of the blue, I met a guy that Alan and I both know, Dave King. Dave's a great prayer warrior. He really is. I can't even remember what I went to see him about, but I'm with Dave, and he's praying with me, and he suddenly stops. Now, I need to tell you, I'm a bit distrustful of a lot of prophetic words. I mean, I often say the next guy who comes up to me and says, I see a tree by a river, does it mean anything? I'm going to say, you're the prophet, you tell me. But I listen, because you know what Dave said to me? He said, God's going to give you some money, but the reason he's going to give it to you is because you know how to give it away. Now, isn't that a funny thing to say? So when we got this sum of money, it brought an enormous responsibility. Now, by the way, I'm still driving a very ordinary car, and, you know, the sum of money was less than a Premier League footballer earns in a week. But it was more money than we'd ever seen in our life. But it wasn't all for us. I'm so grateful to Dave that he gave us that prophetic warning. I need to move on. How are we doing for time? One of the joys of being an itinerant speaker is you can talk as long as you like because you never get invited back twice. Now, he failed to see beyond his wealth. He failed to see beyond his wishes. And he couldn't see beyond his own world. See, what he forgot was that the life he lived here is actually lived in the backdrop of eternity. We are here for a relatively short time. There's nothing morbid about saying that. 7-8 years ago, something like that, I got diagnosed with prostate cancer. And when I went to see the oncologist, he was really good. He had a wonderful bedside manner. Because when he summoned us in, I said to him, "Can my wife come in?" He said, "Oh, she must come in." And then when he sat down and put the file on the desk, his opening gambit was, "Now, Mr. Yule, how honest would you like me to be?" My reply was, "As honest as you can." And he said, "Good, that makes it easier for us." And then he said to me, "Now, we've got to get on with this. If we don't deal with it, you've got 3 years. That's it." Well, I'm very grateful to Margaret for nagging me. By the way, any of you guys in the congregation, get your PSA checked, right? I didn't realize that. I didn't even have any symptoms. I'm grateful for the wonderful NHS, one of the glories of this country, and for everybody who prayed for me. But you know what I'm saying? Life is, there are no guarantees with life. We live it in the backdrop of eternity. Do not make the mistake of thinking you're going to be here forever. Because you ain't. Now enjoy every minute of it. But that's what he forgot. He failed to see the generosity of God. The very fact that he was breathing was because God gave him that breath. Who was it? G.K. Chesterton said, "The sun does not rise every day because of the laws of nature, but because God says, get up and do it again." And he failed to remember the brevity of life. So what's the point Jesus is making? Well, he sums it up at the end. "This is how it will be with everyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich towards God." Two mistakes that people make: they trust in wealth or they worry about life. And against those two things, the allure of wealth and the drag of worry, the Bible places something that we should really desire. It sums it up in one word, and it's especially focused in the book of Proverbs, but it rings all through Scripture. You need wisdom. And wisdom isn't being smart. Wisdom isn't being able to solve problems. Wisdom is recognizing that life is a gift from God. Wisdom is recognizing that the words of Jesus and the teaching of Jesus and the call of Jesus and the death of Jesus and the risen presence of Jesus are the things that make sense of life. So, I appreciate that probably not many of us here are in the super tax bracket. Not many of us may benefit from the tax changes that Boris Johnson is promising. Don't let me get started on that one. But how do we use our wealth? Let me conclude. Am I okay just to finish with a story? Yeah, okay. If you're ever lucky enough to visit New York, you may fly into LaGuardia Airport. LaGuardia Airport is named after a man called Fiorello LaGuardia, who was the mayor of New York during the Depression and during some of World War II. Fiorello LaGuardia was known as Little Flower. He was only 5'4", so he's 2 inches shorter than me. He was only 5'4". He always wore a carnation in his lapel, and on his head he always had a big sombrero. He was a larger-than-life character despite his shortness of stature. He would sometimes, just for the fun of it, go to one of the fire stations in New York and ride on the fire truck with a fireman, just for the fun of it. And when the newspapers went on strike, and in those days there was no television, obviously, he went on the radio because the newspapers were on strike and the kids couldn't read the cartoon page, so he went on the radio and read it for them. That was Fiorella LaGuardia. But here's the best story about Fiorella LaGuardia. It was a bitterly cold night in January 1935. And Fiorella LaGuardia turned up unexpectedly at one of the night courts in one of the very poorest wards in the city. And because he was the mayor, he could do this kind of thing. He dismissed the judge, gave him the night off, and he took over the bench. And amongst the cases that came before him that night were an old woman, very tattered, very shabby, an old woman who had stolen a loaf of bread. And she made a plea to Fiorella LaGuardia, I only stole it because my daughter's husband has deserted her. She's got two kids and the kids were hungry. I stole the bread to feed them. The shopkeeper, understandably, would have nothing of it. He said to Fiorella LaGuardia, Mr. Mayor, you cannot make an exception. This is a bad area. If she gets off, everybody will think they can try it. And Fiorella LaGuardia said, you're right. The law makes no exceptions. And he fined the old lady $10. However, having passed judgment, he took his sombrero, removed $10 from his own wallet, and popped it into the sombrero, and said, but I'm paying it, and the fine is remitted. Then this is a bit I really like. Then he said, furthermore, I'm going to fine everybody in this court 50 cents for living in a city where a poor woman has to steal to feed her grandchildren. So the next day, the newspapers carried the report that $47.50, a princely sum, was given to the old lady. The shopkeeper himself had to contribute 50 cents. Every police officer in the court that night had to contribute 50 cents. And a whole row of petty criminals had all to cough up 50 cents each. And as the old lady walked from the court, and as Fiorella LaGuardia stood to conclude the proceedings, the whole court stood and applauded him. At the very heart of our Christian faith lies generosity. That's a little picture of God. That's a little picture of grace. A God who says, you know what? All of you deserve sentence. There is not one perfectly good person among you. All of us are a mixture of saint and sinner. But I pay the price. That's why I send my son. I pay the price. But the calling on you, if you will follow me, is to be generous. You throw in your 50 cents worth. See, the danger in preaching against wealth like this is that you can preach it in a sense that it makes it feel as if poverty is a wonderful thing. No, it isn't. It is a national disgrace. And every person who sits in the House of Parliament should be utterly ashamed that so many people in this country today have to depend on food banks. It is a national disgrace that people where both parents are working still cannot make enough money to make ends meet. It is shameful. And I preach not party politics. I say all who sit in the House of Commons should be ashamed of that. And we should be ashamed that a country like this, oh, oh, is your mummy dropping a hint? Who's this child's mummy? Come on up. Did you send him up here to do that? I can't. You at least should have had the courage to do it yourself. That's the first thing. That's great. I shall use that story. Little kid comes up and says, "Mummy's watch." Oh, boy. Let me pray. Don't close your eyes. Please don't close your eyes. I want to pray that you'll get blessed, and I like to see what people look like when they're getting blessed. Father, thank you that we can preach the gospel and it ends in laughter. Thank you when the gospel is preached and we get a picture of your generosity. The shame of our own meanness overcomes us. Thank you, too, for the liberty of giving. Thank you for the liberty of sharing all we've got. Thank you for a church like this that has been founded partly, largely, on that determination to help people with financial problems, which are spiritual problems. By the way, I'm just making a little detour here. Do not divide spiritual from material. We live in the real world. And people not having enough money to live on is a spiritual problem. I just made a little detour to tell you that. But thank you. Please help us to be generous. Thank you that this church is founded on the need for generosity and justice. Hello. They're all sending their kids up now. She was holding up a little notice saying, time's up. Thank you, Father, for all your goodness. And thank you because Jesus loves us. This we know, for the Bible tells us so. Amen. Amen.